Windows 2000 is coming out. We're starting to be a significant player in the enterprise, because prior to that, it had all been like 95 was a client operating system, and everybody used Unix in the back end. Windows NT was coming along, and it looked like it could be a significant challenger to Unix in the NT space. But they wanted to find out what their competitive disadvantages were with respect to Unix boxes, and so they commissioned a survey. And one of the strongest things that they got back was, your shell sucks. That command.exe is just an inappropriate automation tool, and that you can't automate stuff in Windows. So much of configuration in Windows is point and click. And that's great if you have one computer. It's okay if you have two. But once you start to get around 5,000 computers, it's not feasible anymore. It just doesn't work. And so they needed to have this automation and scripting tool, and they needed a new shell.
Hello, Jeffrey Snover.
Howdy, how you doing?
It's my pleasure to have you here. It's a little bit like a dream come true. You might get the idea that I say this every time, but it's somehow just like this. Anytime I reach out to people that I never expected to meet in flesh and blood, I'm very happy to have them here on the podcast. So, hello.
Howdy.
We're here at the PowerShell conference in Hanover. And first of all, I think we should say something about your experience here. We are all very excited. What is your impression as the father of that all? Somehow, not of the conference, but of the reason why we're here.
Yeah, it's an exciting conference, right? I mean, we get some of the world's best people in this area, and they're all solving different problems, and we come together, and we have a common language that we're talking. We're able to share tips and techniques. You know, we'll have you'll see something in the talk, and then you'll find that person in the hallway and follow up on it. It's just fantastic. And the thing I like about this crowd is it's very, very deeply technical.
And every single person here wants to reach out to you, talk to you, make some pictures. Is that a burden?
I wouldn't say it's a burden. It's uncomfortable because by my nature, I'm an introvert. You know, I'm the guy, if you go to a party, I'm the guy in the corner staring at his shoes. So it's very awkward to talk to people. But I love to talk to people. I know that they want to meet me. They want to ask me questions. So I try and get out of my comfort zone to do that because I certainly enjoy hearing their success stories. And I hear lots of those. And that's great.
I don't want to wrap up this communication in the first minute, but somehow I think the success of PowerShell and the love that is spread and the engagement that you see, how much do you think does it belong to the people, or does it simply belong to the technique? How important are you and guys like Bruce, who are very open-minded, for the success and the embracement of PowerShell?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't really know. I mean, I've long believed and had the argument that said basically that GUIs were antisocial, right? Because you're there and you use a GUI, you click next, click next, click next. Well, how can you help me? Like, hey, I've got a problem. And what you can say is, well, I don't. What do you mean? Well, I was able to do it. It's like, well, can you help me? And it's like, sort of not really. Like, I could sit next to you and tell you what to click. But with the command line interface and a scripting interface, you can do work. And then when I have a problem, you can share your script with me. And all of a sudden, you've helped me. And in helping me, I've incurred a debt of gratitude. I say thank you. Next time I see you, I'll buy you a beer. And then, guess what? When you have a problem, there's like a dozen different ways you can solve it. And I can look at your work and I can say, wow, that is clever. Not just you've accomplished something, but I see into your mind and I see your skill and your thought process, and I can admire that. And again, you can't do that with a click next. Never have I said to somebody, hey, I just want to share with you confidentially. I just think you are an awesome mouse clicker. You know, that really, the way you click that mouse is really something else. You know, that never happens, but that happens all the time with scripting. Like, wow, look at the inventiveness of that person. So I think by definition, scripting and command line interface is a very social thing. And certainly I think, you know, we might have helped that along the lines by, you know, I think there's a I'll make an analogy to someone was talking about longevity, lifespan, and whether or not you're, you know, some health indicator, like, you know, and they said, well, there's the average, and then there's below average and above average. And there's a huge difference in longevity between the people who are below average on something, weight or blood pressure or something, and the people who are average. Huge difference. But between average and above average, there's no difference in outcome. Okay? So what does that mean? So I think the answer is, I think if we were jerks, it could have a very negative effect on the community, and we're not jerks. That said, being super open, et cetera, I'm not sure it changes that much. I think the key thing was not being a jerk.
Yeah, yeah. But I think I personally would I'm convinced, let me say it like that it's a little bit more, okay. Definitely. But I want to talk to you about the future of automation.
Yeah.
And someone said you can't understand your future if you do not understand the past.
Yes.
So it's obvious that we have to talk about your achievement, what made you a technical fellow.
Yep.
Correct. And I want to start with a very current thing. It happened to be that this month, Terry Myerson, the Windows chief, he will go away from Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And I know from a story that you told that Terry Myerson was very important for the success or for the surviving of PowerShell in its early days.
Yeah, absolutely. It wouldn't have shipped without Terry. So what had happened was, you know, we were doing this PowerShell's Monad, and then there was the Windows, you know, .NET diaspora, the disaster, the blow up, and they were just getting rid of .NET everywhere. And so we made the conscious choice to say, hey, we're going to get out of Windows, and then we'll come back in. That gave us some breathing room, but in reality, you know, they were going to come get us. And it really was as bad as that. I mean, it really was. Anyway, so I had known the head of the exchange program.
Which was?
Dave Thompson at the time. And Dave was the guy who hired me into Microsoft. In fact, my joke was that I never joined Microsoft. I joined Dave Thompson. He was just an awesome executive. And he said, well, you know, I got this team doing something. Maybe they should be using this instead. And so I went and talked to Terry and his team. And they're like, yeah, this is the right thing to do. Now, Terry was an incredible advocate. First, he was a hard nose. Hey, it needs to do this, this, and this. And boy, he just had great set of demands. It was very demanding. And so we, you know, upped our game quite a bit. And then when the Windows team finally did come after us, they were going to get rid of us. Terry was there saying, hey, no, you know, they are critical to my, you know, multi-billion-dollar business. What are you doing? Leave them alone. And so he was a great advocate, you know, great customer, very demanding. The whole implicit remoting, you know, Gia, we talk about Gia now, and people think, oh, wow, that's this new technology. The answer is Terry and his team was demanding of that of us from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, that technology, the core of that technology has been in the product for many years. Mm-hmm. Now, they used it to host Exchange in the cloud, and they had their own implementation, did a lot of heavy lifting, not appropriate for the general purpose community. And finally, at some point, I said, you know what? The Exchange guys were right. Everybody should be doing it this way. And then we did the work to make it easy. That became Gia.
Pretty interesting. And beyond that, the Exchange people, that is common knowledge, they made PowerShell very popular.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because they put it in Exchange 2007, which was a little bit earlier than Windows 2008, mm-hmm. which also had an included Windows PowerShell. From your point of view, how much complaints did you hear about this huge change that Exchange 2007 now is completely different than it was before, just because of PowerShell.
Yeah, so there were definitely some grumbles. I think the biggest signal that we heard was, well, basically, you know, we had written a white paper, you know, the Exchange team and myself, about, you know, Exchange and PowerShell or Exchange and Monad finally get the administration model right. And basically the idea was, prior to this, they had a GUI, and what happened was it was all kind of messed up. Like, first you'd have each individual team deliver a GUI, and then they were all different. So that was a mess. And then they said, okay, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to have a central team deliver a GUI. And then all these feature teams are like, hey, you know, you're a bottleneck, and I can't get my features delivered there. And then the resultant thing was coherent, but it didn't have everything. And then the stuff it had showed everything. And so what we said was the correct model was every feature team delivers a command line experience, a full and comprehensive command line experience. And then a centralized team will take a subset of the things, basically said the 80% of the things that, or 20% of the things that 80% of the people will use, and deliver that as a coherent experience. But then for the advanced people, they've got a command line experience. And what this did was it allowed us to dramatically simplify the user experience. Instead of saying, you know, new user, and there's 14 tabs of properties to fill out, you said new user, and there were a couple tabs. And if you needed those other 12 properties, like, hey, you're an advanced person, use the command line. And so the biggest signal that we heard was, you didn't get 80-20, you got like 70-20, you know, that it wasn't enough. And so then they were able to rapidly iterate, and then most people were pretty happy.
Yeah, from what I remember is that there was some pressure, which showed up as one result of that. Exchange was improved by adding some GUI features.
Yes.
So I think there were a few complaints, right?
Sure.
But the interesting thing is how much of this comes to your ears, how much is reflected on the PowerShell team. When I think about Windows Server...
But wait, you know, that's a very interesting point. One of the challenges we always have is to get the true signal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's easy to get a signal. To get a true signal is very difficult. Because when you say you release something this, and then all of a sudden you hear 100 people complain... Well, does that mean everybody hates it? Or does it mean the people who love it aren't saying anything and the people who hate it are, right? And vice versa. So, you know, like for instance, here we have a number of people who used to work in the military. And they were telling us, I talked to them after the talk, and they were saying, oh, PowerShell is used everywhere. I have no signal of that whatsoever.
Yeah.
And they're saying it's used everywhere for cyber defense. And I had no signal on that at all. And so, yeah, no, they love it. So that, in Windows, we had exactly the same problem. Because in the past, we had no telemetry. Really had no idea who was using what or how they were using it. So it's one of the challenges that we have is trying to get the true signal. I can get a signal, but I don't really know what it means.
I want to focus on the time that PowerShell was a built-in functionality in Windows Server 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there is quite a fun story how it came to Windows System 32, Windows PowerShell version 1.0.
Huh?
This strange path. I think this story must be told because it's very funny, right?
I don't know if it's funny.
Or
it's
not.
Kind of tragic.
Yeah. It can be both.
So, well, let's go back a little bit. So, as I mentioned, and I'm sensitive to the fact that sometimes a story makes people come off as overly negative. And certainly that was my experience. But let me try and be fair to people. Here's what had happened. For a number of different reasons, Bill Gates had been beating everyone up to do .NET. And so then we did Longhorn, that was the code name, and everybody's got to do .NET. Now, everybody's got to do .NET was not the right thing to do, but that was the message everyone heard. And so people were doing all sorts of crazy stuff, and it was never going to work, but it just went down pretty far down the line before it just collapsed of its own weight. And instead of having the deep think, say, hey, what really happened here? Hey, maybe Bill gave us the wrong signal, or too strong a signal, or wasn't refined in a signal. Maybe we didn't do a good job taking that and saying, hey, we hear you, Bill. We understand what you want. Here's how we're going to translate that into things that can do, and here's where we're going to stay the same, and here's where we're going to advance. Maybe it was individual engineers who made bad calls, etc. There's any number of reasons, but it was a disaster. And the team, you know, Mark Twain once said that a cat that jumps on a hot stove will never jump on a hot stove again, but neither will they jump on a cold stove. Well, that's sort of what happened with Windows and .NET. You know, even, you know, they were not going to jump on that hot stove again. .NET had brought them such pain, such disaster, and a lot of people, it hurt their careers, and a lot of people have ruined their careers. Mm-hmm. Okay. And, you know, the guy before you got his career ruined because of something, you're a little reticent to jump on that. Anyway, so they developed, but there was this other group that said, no, this is great technology. We got to keep using it. And so the Windows guys said, okay, well, you know, we have to establish some criteria for when we'll allow .NET into Windows. And so a group of senior Windows architects got together and produced the 7 rules for bringing any .NET code into Windows. And these were very, very difficult things. And part of this was versioning. And so, you know, and there were all sorts of problems with versioning and da-da-da. And it was all confused, right? So first, I don't know if I've told you this story, but basically my position is versioning is not a problem. Okay. Versioning is not a problem because problems can have solutions. Versioning is a dilemma because there is no solution, right? A dilemma just has to be managed. Okay, so that's the first thing you have to get in focus. And then the second thing, and this was my key contribution, was I said, there isn't a versioning issue here. There are 3 different versioning issues here, and they have different characteristics, and they have different solutions. So let's walk through that. And so then I structured things. And as the outcome of that, and because one of the things was no .NET in Windows until you solve the versioning problem. And so this is part of that. And what we said was, oh, well, one of the versioning problems is that the language might change. And so V1 is not V1 of PowerShell, the implementation. It's V1 of PowerShell. And so if we had a massive breaking change, you know, instead of saying for each, we say for each element or something, you know, something, some dramatic change, then we'd say, well, it's PowerShell version 2. In reality, we just call it a new language. But anyway, that made everybody happy. And so finally, you know, 7 of these things, and each one very, very difficult. And each one we were greener than green. We just really nailed it. And so then finally we were ready. We knocked on the door and we said, okay, hey, we have solved all of these 7 problems. No one else has done it. We're the team. We've done it. And then we found out that there's an 8th rule. And you only learn about the 8th rule after you learn the first 7. And the 8th rule was, no frickin' .NET and Windows. And so I'm not making this up. Literally, we sent in our letter saying, okay, we're ready to come back into Windows. Here's all the things. And the head executive at the time said, you withdraw this. You know, send mail. Like, withdraw this request. I'm not letting .NET into Windows. And I'm sitting there with the program manager like, oh, my heavens, well, what do we do? And he looks at me and says, here's what we do. And he wrote back and he said, no, you turn it down. And so that's what the guy did. And then that forced the conversation where, hey, hear what you're saying, but there are other business concerns here, other business leaders, and it meets their business needs, and it met all the requirements. And that's ultimately how it got shipped. So in fact, there were a lot of other executives that were crucial. Bob Muglia, a fantastic executive, he basically said, hey, I understand this is critical to the server business, right? Windows is going to be a data center operating system, and for that, I have to have this automation. They've solved all the problems. I understand you have some bad history here, but we met the criteria, and we're going to move forward.
Did anyone understand that when you ship Windows Server 2008 R2 and delivered PowerShell version 2? Does anyone contact you and say, hey, we raised the number?
Everyone.
Everyone? Because yeah. Everyone thinks this is the generic PowerShell version, oh, right?
Yeah. yes. So lots of people asked me that. And we knew that was going to happen. But you had to have it there. There was a number of things like that. Like Snap-ins was another one. We hated Snap-ins. Everyone hated Snap-ins. But basically, you know, Colin Powell, I think the world of Colin mm-hmm. Powell, in his book, he talked about people, you know, fine people, brilliant people who destroyed their careers because there came a point where they had to, his phrase was, pay the king, give the king his coin. And if you don't give the king his coin, you don't get to move on. And so, and he says their entire career, because they wouldn't give in on one thing, and so their entire career went away. So it's the same sort of thing. Every now and again, you got to just pay the king his coin, and you get to move on, yeah. And then you can do good things. So there were a couple things like that. We had to pay the king his coin. Snap-ins was one. We hated that thing. We did it. This versioning thing, that was another one. And what I kept saying was, listen, let me tell you why this is the solution, but why we don't have to implement it. Because, you know, in reality, it's like if you drive down the Oregon coast, you see these tsunami evacuation signs. And I says, anybody in this room ever used one of those? No. I mean, it's important to have, but no one's ever going to use it. Mm-hmm. So maybe what we do is we don't, in this case, maybe we have it because now mm-hmm. we figured out how to solve it,
yeah.
But we don't use it until we need it. And the answer was no. So, well, you know what? If I fought on that, I would have lost and we wouldn't have been able to ship. So I paid the king his coin. We have this kind of stupid thing. Everybody asked me, hey, isn't that stupid? To which I say, yep, you're right.
Yeah, to skip ahead in time, if we talk about PowerShell Core,
yes,
we have that versioning, but in the proper way. So nowadays, if you install PowerShell Core, usually you reflect the versioning number within the file path. So this is what people expect, and now we have it.
Yeah,
of course. To wrap this up to the file extension, what was first? Because .ps1... also obviously a little bit strange.
Yeah.
Was that first because of the conflict with PostScript or?
No. It's all had to do with this.
Everything is the same.
Yeah, so. Exactly. I mean, before PS1, I think it was MSH1 or MSH. And then we had to go to versioning. We got the name, PowerShell. Yeah, yeah. That was a last minute change. We had to change everything.
Okay. That's a good keyword. Honestly, I really did like Monad, the term Monad. And of course, you can't ship this. You need some proper wording for the marketing guys. And I thought Microsoft Shell is a good term. MSH, I really like that. Today, I think it wouldn't have been so clever because nowadays we get rid of the Microsoft and Windows thing.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be open-minded. So maybe PowerShell is the perfect name. So can you say something about who invented this term PowerShell? Because Monad,
was
you?
Yeah.
Who was that?
Yeah. So we had a program manager. Actually, it was a marketing manager, I guess. Scott Ottaway. And he drove a whole naming study, and we brought in consultants, and they had a whole bunch of names. OmniShell was one. I liked OmniShell. And there were all these things, and then there was this PowerShell. And then they did this whole thing, long conversation. I really liked Monad. I really wanted Monad. And everybody really wanted Monad. But the marketing guys said, nope, we want to do PowerShell. I mentioned it, Bob Mowgli. He was sort of the executive sponsor of this. He went and said, no. Said, what do you mean, no? And he said, it's going to be Monad. And the marketing guy said, but Bob, I own this decision. And Bob said, yeah, but only if you get it right. And they're like, wait, that's not how it goes. He's like, yeah, but that's a bad name. And so they said, hey, you know what? We'll do a study. And so that kind of like got the pot off the boil for a second, because otherwise it was just going to be by fiat. Anyway, so the marketing guys went and did the study. I'm not making this up. And he talked to, I don't know, hundreds of people, and they would ask questions like this. And I'm literally not making this up. They would say, which name better conveys a sense of power, Monad or PowerShell? which name better conveys a shell, Monad or PowerShell? At the end of the survey, they had statistical evidence showing that PowerShell was a better name. And so, you know, as much as I rolled my eyes at the technique, they won the day. It was PowerShell. And then after they kind of forced it, it was something that I learned to love. And I thought, no, they actually made the right call. It was a fantastic name. So they did good.
We already touched this, and just because we're talking about that,
I'm not sure Monad, I ever told that story.
Monad is Monad. No, right now, I mean, Monad is something that you need a university degree to understand the philosophy.
Mm.
Can you tell within a very short period of time, from 5 hours, something like that? Can you tell how did this touch you? This idea of Monad, it's very, very hard to understand. What is the essence that made you pick up this term and the philosophy, or however you want to call that, and put it in your work? Because this is not IT related on first sight.
Yeah, right. Well, so my background, right, is physics and then philosophy, right? And so as I studied philosophy, I realized that there were two worldviews, right? Kind of Western worldview and Eastern worldview. And the Western worldview, everything's made up of atoms. But then Leibniz had this idea that, well, everything was made up of monads. And a monad, the discrete unit, you know, the basic building block of the universe, was a unit of consciousness. And that consciousness would sometimes decide to manifest itself as matter, and sometimes it would decide to aggregate with other matter to effect a purpose, and that these higher structures would join with other higher structures to effect purposes, right? So particles into atoms, atoms into molecules, molecules into structures, etc., all forming higher and higher purposes. So in this worldview, it was all based upon composition. And that's what PowerShell was. It was a world where, hey, I wasn't going to build a command line, do it, and it does everything. I was going to build all these little components that then you structured together to solve some big purpose, and then it went away. So that's what influenced me.
So Lego would be another name that would fit the needs, right? But maybe some Danish company would offend you in this case. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Back in the early days, I know from Bruce Payette that he came more or less by accident to Microsoft, and he did a very funny talk about his early days, talking about being a foreigner. He's Canadian, with such a strange name. He told me anybody thought that he's from France or whatever. So he really he came to Microsoft by accident, because simply his company was bored. And then you somehow on the floor, someone focused on Bruce and told you, talk to this guy, or the other way around. So you became the perfect couple, from what I know until now. And my question is, if you go back in these early days, it's obvious that you and Bruce are very, very important for the very early days. But my question is, how many people does it take to build a shell?
Yeah.
So who's involved in that? If you might not want to drop all the names, but from a non-programmer's perspective, it's pretty hard to measure how many people does it need to build this stuff.
Yeah, well, actually, so if you listen to Bruce's talk today, and I think it will be made public, he gave a two-part talk about the history of PowerShell. And really, he skimmed over things so lightly. But even then, you know, it was like a multi-hour talk, right? So really, you know, shell. Well, most people, when they hear a shell, like if I could produce a Unix shell, like one person a couple weeks, because it's a pretty straightforward thing. But that's not what we have here, right? We have a very sophisticated, distributed, multi-machine, ultra-secure, distributed management infrastructure that has an embeddable automation engine and a language, and then a shell. Okay, so it's really quite complex. So the answer is, I'm always terrible at like quantity. So I don't know how many people we've had on it. But I will say that we've had lots of people that were absolutely key. So, and at some point when we shipped version one, the manager came to me and said, well, who's responsible for language? And I said, you know, the language, Bruce Payette and Jim Truer co-designed the language. And I'll tell you, like, they just did a fantastic job. They did 10x better than I thought was possible. And they said, yeah, but who developed it? And who designed it? I said, well, they did it together. I said, well, if you had to give 51% credit to someone, who would it be? I said, go away. That's a stupid question. So anyway, they just did a knockout job on the language. Lee Holmes has had his hands on everything, but is like the core owner for all the security. And by far, this is the most secure language that history's ever seen.
He wasn't part from the very beginning, from or the am very I beginning. Wrong?
He was in version one, but not from the very beginning.
Yeah.
So he had gotten the early betas, and he had all this great feedback. And so I went, and I said, boy, this guy's pretty awesome. I'm going to go buy him lunch. And so we bought him lunch, and like, you know, if you're interested. And
he's doing a bunch of stuff right now.
Fantastic.
Yeah, over the couple of years.
Yep. Kenneth Hansen, he was there. Actually, he was the first guy I recruited to the team because he had been working on a configuration management system. You know, it took us 14 years, but we finally shipped it with desired state configuration. But I hired him to go and do that. And he played a key role on a bunch of areas like the namespaces and modules. And, you know, all along the line, we've had people that have done just knockout jobs. And I'll say the thing that I'm most proud of, I mean, I definitely was the owner of a number of the key concepts. But the thing I'm most proud of is that I created a framework where awesome people could come and contribute, you know, bring their awesomeness and do so in a framework where it added up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bill Gates used to joke and he said, Microsoft, you know, we are great at hiring the world's best talent. We're just not so great at making their IQs add versus subtract.
Yeah.
And that's what I think we, you know, I did. I take pride in creating an environment where awesome people could be awesome and it added up together.
So to sum this up, from what I heard, less than 10 people who are the core, the heart of the very early days to build this up.
Oh, the very early days? Let's see. So I would say the very early days was largely, I'll just say that sort of the core principles, the core principles were really worked out through a series of, I'm bad with times and durations, but probably 8 to 14 months where we would go in to each other's offices, and sometimes it was two and sometimes three, sometimes four, but myself, Kenneth Hansen, Bruce Payette, Jim Truer, that's kind of the
you
the
must
key
not forget
four.
Someone, because saying if
yeah, I'll just say
listen
I'm old.
To this then.
I'm old, and I'm sure I forgot somebody. Now we had other people who'd come in for a certain element. You know, Daryl Ray, very important player in version one. He was the key program leader. But in terms of the kind of core principles, that four group of people were always in the core. Actually, you know what would be easy to do is to go take a look at the original patents and take a look and see who was on those original patents.
Yeah.
Because there were quite a few.
Yeah, that's the things that I really like that. This is living history. You can talk to the people who did some very important stuff. It's only 10 years ago or 20 or 30 years. And you don't have the chance if it comes to Rome, ancient Rome. You can't talk to the people. So in these days of Windows XP, once you told us that you were also in charge of WMIC, which really surprised me because WMIC was such a hidden star in my life. I could show this beautiful tool to anyone and nobody knows it before I jump into the room. So nobody knows about it, knew about it back in those days. But it was so powerful. But on the other hand, not so easy to use.
No, horrible.
But you told us there is a relationship because you learned something from WMIC that led to the design of the PowerShell. Can you explain a little bit about what went wrong in WMIC?
Yeah.
So that you think today with PowerShell we have a much better solution because the data is the same. It's WMI.
Yeah. Yeah, so the key thing that I learned from Wimix, so basically I came in and said we need to do command line interfaces. And so then we had one project that just said, hey, I'm going to spend millions of dollars on contractors to write individual commands. And I think we got 40 of those things, like 40 commands, man, that's not many. And then I went and said, hey, I got this other problem. This other problem is people spend all this time and energy to write a WMI provider, and then they don't see any value. Like with a perf counter, you see a performance counter, a line goes up and down. But here we say, well, do all this hard work, and then somebody might buy Tivoli, and then they'll use it. And it's like, well, that's too disconnected. So we need to give them an experience, an immediate gratification. So let's write a command line interface. And I knew that what was going to happen was the team wanted to say, well, let's do the same approach, and then I'll write I'll write individual commands for each one of those. And I knew if we did that, what ended up happening was I wouldn't get many commands because we had written so much code and then we didn't ship it because we couldn't be tested. So instead I said, hey, let's do it this way. Let's write a core engine and then we'll write this metadata that drives the core engine to work against this common interface, WMI. And they're like, no, that's a dumb idea. I don't want to do that. And I said, yeah, I'm not asking. Here's how we're going to do it. And so I jammed that on them. And they did not see it. They thought it was stupid. Senior guy making us do all this stupid stuff. But I knew that what it meant was that I could get that core engine validated. And then this metadata, well, that wouldn't be viewed as something that needed to be tested before it shipped. And so once we had this engine in place, I was able to then spend 2 weeks of my own time writing, and I wrote like 72 of these metadata things, and boom, they were off to the races. But then what happened was it was working so well, I said, hey, you know, we should add this feature and this feature and this feature. So I got a little bit extra money to invest in this. We added those features, and then they applied to everything. So what I learned was, hey, if we get this partitioning right and have most of the work being done by the engine and then only the work, and this is where we ended up with commandlets and this therefore monads, was to make those things as small as possible. Now what that did was, because they were as small as possible, that meant when I asked somebody to do something, it was the smallest thing necessary and the bulk of the work was done by the engine. And that I got a consistent user experience. I minimized the cost I was asking people to do and doing it in a framework that I could invest and make everything better. So if you think about it, that's the heart of PowerShell, right? Somebody writes a very small amount of effort to get a commandlet, and then I provide remoting, a common syntax. I provide workflow. I provide a GUI. I can expose it through a web. I can expose it through delegated administration, through Jira. I do all that. And they didn't do anything to get any of that benefit. So that value proposition really resonated. In fact, in the later days, I just started talking to people about this. WMIC, I don't know if you know this, but it generates XML, and then you process the XML through a series of XSLT transforms. In fact, you can sequence and have multiple XSLT transforms. So what I was doing was I was experimenting with pipelines of XML data. And in fact, that was my first .NET prototype, was to say, basically I ran out of funding, so we shipped with what we had. Yeah. But then I started and I said, hey, let's do this for real. Let's have a real pipeline of XSLT transforms. Turns out XSLT is just hideous. And so that didn't work at all. But while I was at it, I realized, hey, wait a second, .NET has what WMI has, this common reflection interface. I can do this for .NET. And that's how it all happened.
So somehow this is the birth of this idea of a pipeline transferring objects.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Because what happened was, I got these things, and then with the XSLT transform, I turn it into a table. With an XSLT transform, I turn it into a list or a CSV. And we did all that, and it's like, wow, I can invest, and everything gets more powerful uniformly without their investment.
Yeah, that's great. That's
or their cooperation.
And it was new. Did you ever see something comparable? I guess this is really a fresh idea to have a an object-based pipeline?
Yeah,
I've never seen something like that before.
Nope. So the object-based namespace, yes. People say, "Oh, you know, you ripped off the idea of the Unix unified namespace." Yeah. I said, "No, I ripped off Apollo's unified namespace." Yeah. I used to work for Apollo Computers, and we had a unified object-oriented namespace. Now, what's the difference? In Unix, they have a unified namespace, and everything looks like a file. In Apollo and in PowerShell, you interact with everything as you interact with a file, but what you get is whatever it is. So when I do a dir, I can navigate cd into the directory or the registry and do a dir, and then when I get something, I get the real registry object. It has registry properties, etc. It has registry methods. It's not a file. So it's much more powerful.
Yes, so it's amazing.
They had that idea. didn't go as far with it as we have, but they had that idea. But no, the object pipeline, that was my kind of key contribution. Yeah. That and the adaptive type system.
Yeah.
The adaptive type system basically said, hey, degree to which it's .NET, that's great, but a whole bunch of people are implementing their own type systems within .NET, and I got to denormalize those things.
There is a shortcut to what we currently see. The interaction between Linux and Windows, Unix-based operating systems, you always explain that Unix is a text-based, string-based, file-based operating system, and Windows is API-driven.
Right.
So it comes together at this point, right? This idea of objects and the idea of an API.
Mm-hmm.
If we now move to Linux and push PowerShell to these operating systems, the key concept that had to be implemented is moving forward to objects, right?
Yeah.
So REST APIs, stuff like that is super important for the future. That is the intended purpose, right?
Yeah. So basically, the way I frame it is, so when we take PowerShell and we move it to Linux, why would anybody care? And there's a couple different reasons. One, we care because we want to have a uniform Microsoft builds, manage, and products. And so I want to have a uniform infrastructure to manage everything. And it turns out a bunch of people have managing products, and so that's a desirable thing. One, manage an infrastructure to manage everything. Number two is I got a group of individuals, Windows admins, who've learned a technique, and now they can manage not just Windows, but they can use exactly the same skills to manage Linux. And now all of a sudden, they become more valuable, and that's great. So they become the heroes for their companies. And then three, for the Linux guys, well, you just say, well, hey, you know what? It's just another shell. In Linux, there are lots of shells, and you might have a favorite one, but you know, people change. Exactly. You know, it used to be everybody using Bash. I was a big C shell user. I love C shell. Then everybody was K shell when we started project. It was all K shell, K shell, K shell. And now it's Bash. But so, you know, shells follow fashion. So you know what? This is another shell. Try it. You might like it. Now, hey, we do a great job. The benefit of the PowerShell is that it's, one, it's a distributed shell. It's a distributed infrastructure. And that, two, is we really knock it out of the park when you get structured data and you deal with APIs. Well, the story is, and I like to kind of rib my Linux friends a little bit, and I'm saying that day by day, Linux world is becoming more like Windows. And they hate that. Like, what are you talking about? You're really violent. Well, because of this architectural difference, and in the Linux world, more and more of it's being surfaced as REST APIs returning JSON objects. And when you do that, we just knock it out of the park. We do really, really well there. And then they're like, yeah, actually, you're right.
For example, the success of Docker container technology in the Linux space, this is exactly what we talk about. It's built upon the idea of having an API, a web service. It's built upon the idea of have JSON data, structured data that you can easily convert from strings to objects. And, of course, we might expect that the world moves forward these technologies, of course. So you open source PowerShell. First of all, you said PowerShell is complete. The full CLR.
Windows PowerShell.
The Windows PowerShell, the full CLR PowerShell.
Yeah.
So we're done. And now we start from scratch and we improve PowerShell, but we're doing this in the first step with a subset of technology because we have to focus on .NET Core, because we need a proper base that works on Windows, works on Linux. Being at the conference here, this seems normal for everyone. Everyone is used to work with this new concept. But it will take some time till all your customers get it right. Mm-hmm. Because PowerShell 6 today is more a concept. Mm-hmm. It's an investment in future. You can't actually do proper administration of SharePoint, Exchange, exactly. We have to move a giant leap towards a future where all these side effects are removed, all mm-hmm. the dependencies, and until we can rely on the core and the core of .NET and the core of PowerShell, and we will be operating system agnostic.
I challenge that, though. Because, that's what people think, but that's what I hope to have dispelled in my mm-hmm. keynote. So if people watch my keynote from the PowerShell European Conference 2018 for your readers, what I showed was a prototype of something we're working mm-hmm. on and we'll release in the next couple months called R Module. Mm-hmm. And R Module basically says, hey, I don't need to wait. I don't need to get a SharePoint to convert to Core in order for me to manage SharePoint using Core. And so the idea is that you import a module, you can import a remote module. Mm-hmm. And this is just a simplified way to do what people could do mm-hmm. for a long time, which is implicit remoting.
Yeah. And proxy commandlets.
Exactly. And I think it's conceptually easier for people to get. So you import a module and you get those access to those commandlets. So now the point is you're in PowerShell version 6 and you can import a module that runs in PowerShell version 5 and you can continue to run all the commandlets. So I think that that's going to be very popular, and I think more people are going to be able to adopt PowerShell version 6 than currently think they'll be able to. I think most people are sitting there saying, hey, I've got to wait till, you know, 2 years or whatever before. And I think they'll find out that, no, actually, one, you can do a lot right now. Two, as soon as we get everybody to sign off and get all the SIM commandlets moved over, that gets us to like almost 1,900 commandlets. We already know a bunch of Windows modules already work, like Hyper-V. They did that work a while ago. We get more to do that. But I think in pretty short order, we'll hit critical mm-hmm. mass. And then with this R command to deal with the long tail, I think people are going to move over pretty quickly. But, you know, watch that space. You know, next year, I think people will be able to do it before people do it. So next year, this time next year, I think you'll say people who've tried it can do it, but not everybody's doing that. 2 years from now, I think you'll see. But I'm always bad at judging
I'm pretty good. 2020 for the record.
Yeah. I'm pretty accurate at judging where things will go. I'm not particularly accurate on how long it takes to get there.
Yeah. I always like it when you tell the story that you running around in the Microsoft campus, the command line guy, and then some people talk to you and say, hey, Jeffrey, the concept of Windows, did you really get it? And if we add now the concept of open source, embracing the Linux community, I'd like to combine that to one question. There is a deep change in Microsoft in seeing things, right? Outside of Redmond.
Yep.
People are ready to embrace other technologies. People are ready to deliver Linux workloads a lot. And there are no ressentiments. People do not reject it. How does that come? Is that all Satya Nadella? Because you always talk this way. Can you tell a few things about
it? First, to be clear, that we've always had individuals who've had this flame, you know, kept this flame. But the reality is there was not institutional or environmental support for it. So a lot of people came and said, like, hey, we got to do this, let's do this, and met such resistance that they left, right? And certainly I thought about that many times. So we've had that there. But the institutional change really came with Satya. And really the big thing was, hey, we can be much more than we are. Like, you guys, you're all happy with things, you're content, we've done very successful, but what you're failing to see is where we could be and where we are going. And where we are going is not, you know, the customers we have. We are going to grow this market, and we're going to grow our share, and we're going to help the world by getting out of our heads, getting out of our egos, listening to our customers, figuring out what it takes to make them successful, and giving it to them. And if we do that, we will grow our business, we will help people, and we'll grow our business from doing so. So a lot of people are like, well, what's that mean? Does he really mean it? Sometimes people say these big things, but they don't really mean it. And then when there was that picture, Satya Nadella with the picture, Microsoft hearts Linux, everyone's like, wait, what? What? Like, Satya loves Linux? What? Is that really true? And then step by step, he has backed up this. And then step by step, individuals are like, oh, it's real. We can do it. And so this is culminated with this week, the announcement of Alpha Sphere, where for the first time, Microsoft is shipping a Linux distribution. That's right, Microsoft shipping a Linux distribution. Now, a lot of people go crazy over that, and it's great. It's huge news, but here's a reality. In 1996, Microsoft was the world's largest Unix distributor with Xenix. So it's not that crazy, but you know, somehow we had an executive that was particularly pugilistic on this point and made some very unfortunate statements and gained a lot of ill will. And we've just got to unwind that. You know, I had a reporter come out to me and said, this is all whatever, you know, come on my show and convince me that you love Linux. And I said, dude, you know, that framing is not going to work here. You know, if you're skeptical, you know, we know I'm not going to convince you with words. The only way I'm going to convince you is with consistent action. Mm-hmm. And I think any fair person can look back on the Microsoft as of such in Adela and see that we have been consistent. We've said he's said a story, and then we've consistently been executing on that step by step by step. Office applications on Android and iOS, on Mac OS, open sourcing, .NET, SQL running on Linux. Mm-hmm. And now finally, you know, so there's just so many points in this thing and now doing our own Linux thing. So I think that, you know, my words aren't going to convince anybody, but our actions, I think, will.
Let's focus on some issues.
Yeah.
To be honest,
sure.
Not everything is perfect.
No.
What do you think about people that claim technology like desired state configuration? This is over-engineering. This is way too much to do simple tasks. What is the main point behind desired state configuration? It can be a mess. It's not an easy one-liner to write a desired state configuration, but it's of huge importance in terms of Azure. So how can you convince someone that he or she should invest in technology like desired state configurant? I know there is this nice little word that you love from the philosophy, idempotent.
Yeah.
I guess this all comes together there.
Yeah. Let's see. So let's break it down. Because there's some things, let's see. So what do I think works well and what do I think does not work well? So first off, desired state configuration really just came out of the observation that, let's see which way to go here. I'll have to go this way. So right now there are a lot of people that have products to sell that have this big blah, blah, blah. We invented blah, blah, blah. And it's all nonsense, right? The reality is all these products are all based upon Unix make, right? The developer tool make. You say, hey, I want to make this executable. It depends upon these things. And if they're not in the right order, here's how to build this, compile these things. And then that turns into a set of recursive things. Oh, in order for those things to be true, they need to these dependencies, etc. And what we all observed was that, hey, we can take that concept and apply it to systems. Like, I want the system to be in this condition, and then I can make in that condition, and then later I can say, make sure it's in that condition, and then recursively walk down and find the things that aren't in that condition and then remake them. Okay? So that's the kind of core concept. Now, really, you know, you can sort of do this with PowerShell today. I mean, this is sort of what Bruce's observation was. Hey, you know, what we find is that everybody who's configuring systems is using PowerShell scripts. The problem is that they're using inconsistent interfaces to do so, and that they're not idempotent. So, you know, it's as simple as, hey, please write your script that has a get, a set, and a test. And make sure the set is idempotent. And now idempotent basically means I can call it over and over and over and over and over again, and it has the same effect. So that's the difference between saying add one is not idempotent, because if I add one to one, it gets two. I do it again, I get three, I get four, I get five. So that's not idempotent. Set to one is idempotent, because I set it to one, its value is one. I do it again, I do it 1,000 times, it's always one. So that's what you want to do, is to write configuration. Now, it turns out that's really hard to do. So that's sort of the heart of it. You know, that's one. That's just an intrinsic issue. And here I'd actually say that, just to be fair, it is much harder to write idempotent code on Windows than it is Linux. Right? On Linux, the state is well defined. It's easy to, you know, it's in a configuration file for the largest, for the most point. Whereas Windows, because we're API oriented, this is one of the benefits of the Linux architectures. It's easier to write idempotent code. And that's why, by the way, why a number of these tools have done better on Linux than on Windows historically. So that's number one. Number two was, so then we said, okay, we'll have this desired state configuration model, and it will be cross-platform. Being cross-platform, we then chose standards, and that was WMI and MOFS. In reality, those days, that was probably a mistake, because those technologies are great, but they're sort of sunset. Their day is, their best days are behind us, not in front of us. You know, really, if I had gone with JSON and just ignored, you know, had my own agent. The problem is so many people have stepped on the my own agent problem, that rake, over and over again. So anyway, I think that was a mistake, something we're going to fix, but that was a mistake. But then the second thing is, desired state configuration really is, as it's expressed through PowerShell, is a platform technology and was explicitly designed to be a platform technology. So specifically, as lead architect for Windows Server, I said, I got a problem. And my problem is I got the chef guys trying to convince these people to write chef providers, and the puppet guys are here trying to convince people to do this. And then, you know, a bunch of people like that. And then they're competing with each other saying, well, hey, I can manage SQL better. And well, they can manage SQL better, but I can manage Exchange better. And from a platform perspective, that was a disaster. So what I needed to do was to say, hey, everybody, listen, we will use, and by the way, they could, they're small companies, they could only get some people to play, some people they couldn't. So it was a kind of a mess from an ecosystem standpoint. So what I did was I said, hey, we will get everybody to write a common set of providers, and then we'll give you infrastructure and you can code to it. So then everybody will be able to manage the same things to the same level, and then you go compete on this feature or that feature, whatever. Now, as part of that, in order to make it worthwhile for the people writing providers, it has to be value outside of those products. And that was the PowerShell scripting environment. So that's the thing I think you mentioned was a little bit too complex. And it is, because it is not a solution like Chef and Puppet. They really are solutions. And so what people have done is they built their own scripting solution on top of that infrastructure, and that's pretty complex. And we, to date, have only provided a solution in the context of Azure Configuration Management. But we have that now, and we'll continue to invest in that and make that a better solution. But we are pretty far behind.
If I break this
down. By the way, is that a fair breakdown, do you think?
Yes, of course. Yeah, it's very detailed. If I break it down in my words, in desired state configuration, We have the DSC resource that actually does the job.
Yep.
And we have, yeah, in the old age, we would have said we have a kind of ini file. We have the configuration, which is, it's always the same. It's a common language that you write down how you want it to be. Is it fair to say that the DSC resources should be provided by the product? So if I have a certain technology, if I'm a software, a vendor, like VMware or whatsoever, I care about the DSC resources and the configuration standards are made by Microsoft. So thinking about this, today the DSC resources mainly come from the community and from the PowerShell team. Wouldn't it make more sense that the SQL guys, the Exchange guys, they should deliver the DSC resources because they know their product? Is it fair to say this would be the perfect way?
Yeah, that's a great point. So let's now say every cloud has a silver lining. Every silver lining has its cloud. So indeed, in the new world, right, Satya came and said, hey, we're going to do things differently, and we're going to be focused in on the customer. I want you to focus in on the customer, and I'm going to get rid of a lot of bureaucracy for you. And so we got rid of a lot of bureaucracy, right, and stuff that people had to do that really wasn't customer-focused. Right. And that's given people a lot of agility. But in the same token, things like the common engineering criteria have fallen away. And so now each team basically listens to their customers and does, you know, I got so many resources and I got to maximize the benefit for my customers. And then I go talk to these, a different group talks to a different set of customers and they do the same thing. So what this means is that the role of consistent architecture is decreasing in this world. And as I come in and I say, hey, you should write this desired state configuration. They say, well, you know what? I just talked to 100 customers and none of them told me I should write a desired state configuration for them. I say, well, yeah, but they need that. Like, well, if they needed it, they would have told me. And, you know, we're here focused in on my customers, not making you happy, so I'm going to do this. And so that's a bit of the messy world. And you'll see that in a lot of things, like the Azure CLI, right? Oh, wait a second, that doesn't follow the naming standards, et cetera. It's exactly what happened. Hey, we have an urgent need to go deliver a command line interface to Linux. It's like, oh, but I'm working on that. It's like, yeah, maybe you're going to deliver it. I need it now. And so they went and did their own thing, built it on Python. Some people overinterpret that, like, oh, it's a shift to Python. It is not a shift to Python. It is this team talked to those customers who were not going to use Azure because, or were not using Azure because they couldn't have a good Bash experience to manage it. So they said, man, we cannot have that. We're solving this problem now. Jeffrey, you know, best of luck, but we're not waiting for you. And so they went and built something, and then they tailored it for the Bash community. So that's a bit of a mess. But here's the reality. Okay, fine. We're also going to get PowerShell commandlets there. That's actually a very good team. This one isn't as bad as an example as some of the other ones. So you'll have both environments. But even if you didn't, even if they just had the Azure AZ commandlets, you can invoke those from PowerShell. And you can put a PowerShell. I mean, PowerShell really was meant, and this is the thing I brought to the table. I said, hey, the world has been, the world is, the world always will be a messy place. And the goal of PowerShell is to be able to deal with that mess, to provide a consistent experience, high-level, task-oriented, verb-noun experience across lots of things. And, yep, it would be best if the people, providing stuff did it. But as long as it gets done, that's what's needed.
Yeah, we're almost approaching a full circle if you mention the verb-noun idea. If we go back to your Monad manifesto, the first approach was to use regular commands. So the thing verb-noun came later.
Well, actually, it was noun/verb to begin with because I was being DCL, VMS DCL compliant.
Okay.
Or compatible.
Yeah. Who had that idea?
It was me.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I want to focus on is today we have a couple of a couple of elements, let me say it like that. You mentioned one, Azure CLI. Mm-hmm. Another good example is Docker.exe. Mm. We are heading towards a world where we more and more do not use commandlets because we have something else that is better in this case. So I would say Docker.exe is better than the not even complete commandlets. Would you care if we approach a point in time that people more and more use those sophisticated tools? Do you really care about the idea of the commandlet? Or what is the most important thing? Is the commandlet, the idea of this easy-to-use wording and stuff like that, is that an integrated, a must-have for the philosophy of PowerShell? Would it hurt you? Do you get what I mean?
I know exactly what you're talking about. So at the end of the day, you think about the user and think about what they need to do and then what they're going to be successful at. And so you're sitting there, let's just say you learned Docker and you figured out that. And now you want to go manage a disk. Did that help you?
No.
Okay, AZCLI. Did it help you with AZCLI? Did AZCLI help you with Docker? Do any of these, when Kubernetes, how about kubectl? Did it help you with kubectl? Right? What does dash L mean in AZCLI?
Nobody knows, of course.
What's it mean in kubectl, et cetera? Right? So when you say, like if your whole world is Docker, like I do nothing but Docker, metaphysically impossible, then oh, yes, it's optimized for that. I'm not even sure that's true, but let's just say it is. Like, oh, that is a great experience for that. All I do is kubectl, it's optimized for that. But as soon as you say, well, actually, I got to do this and this and this and this, then you have the choice of, I see why this is good, right? The point about PowerShell is if you learn Exchange and then you're responsible for SQL, guess what? You know how to manage SQL. Get command, get dash star. Oh, here are all the nouns. Oh, I get it. Get command slash, slash what if, et cetera. So the point was that you can guess. And by the way, which of those things support what if? Confirm, right?
Yeah, of course.
So I think that the PowerShell really is focused in on the user experience. Now, here's the thing. Either adds value or doesn't, full stop. And it does not require those providers to deliver that experience. I mean, it would be great if it did, the optimal thing. But the reality is, if it adds value, the community will provide that layer, and then you'll have that experience. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, I just believe in truth and physics, right?
Yeah.
You know, if the physics is right, the right thing's going to happen. I've empowered the community. I've empowered the ecosystem in the community to have as coherent or as messed up as environment as makes sense for them. If it makes sense, just another shell, hey, I can tie together this incoherent experience with that incoherent experience with that incoherent experience. You can do that with a shell. That's what shells do. Or you can say, hey, I'm going to take this incoherent experience and transform it into a common one and then do it here and then do it here. And then I'm just going to deal with a coherent experience on top of all of those. Either model works. And both models
require a shell. To summarize it, it is very important. When I start a classroom, I do a lot of teaching, and I really like to teach beginners. And I do ask people on the day one, how many commands do you use? Ping, ipconfig, stuff like that. And it's pretty clear, it's always the same, that people really do use 5 commands, maybe 10. The sophisticated people, maybe 20. But all of a sudden, you have a PowerShell and you have thousands of commands. Mm-hmm. So, and this qualified kind of guessing, this is what makes a difference, right?
Yeah.
And of course, this is not in Azure CLI. This is not in Docker.exe. This is not in all the stuff that is explicitly one command, and that's it. It might be as sophisticated as it is. So thinking about that, we have a ton of commandlets.
Yeah.
And there are naming issues. Is that a time bomb, if you think about it? For example, new VM.
Yeah.
This is in Hyper-V. This is also in VMware.
Yeah.
Should you have done a better job enforcing that people stick to the guidelines with the prefix? Or what's the solution if we get more and more PowerShell commandlets and we have an overlap of naming?
Okay, so funny you should ask that question. So in I'm having a similar issue in Azure Stack. Different, but similar in the sense of what I've told the team basically was, because we're delivering an appliance experience with Azure Stack. And I said, hey, I want you to observe something. Anytime we have not been a hard ass on a particular topic, we have regretted it and our customers have been hurt by it. So I think finding that balance between being open and letting people do whatever they want and being a hard ass is right. And I think that we should have been a hard ass. Like, we didn't do a naming enforcement or naming checking until version 2. Why? Because as hardcore as we were, like super hardcore, here are the verbs, here's the nouns, da-da-da-da-da, for some reason, Citrix believed that Citrix was a verb. And we just like, you just couldn't make this stuff up. And when we saw that, it's like, okay, stop. We need to fix this. And so then we started to enforce that. We didn't do anything around prefixes, and I probably should have. I should have probably required that. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Very, very interesting.
And like, I hate the Azure RM prefix.
Yeah, yeah,
you're just totally like fine, too long. But they're going to fix that and make it AZ. You know, 2 to 4 characters. And I don't know, it's one of those things. Here's what I think one of the problems that I have that the Unix community doesn't. Unix community from its get-go has been command line interface, right? Start off with a TTY. Everything's done on the command line interface. Everybody in that world gets the experience because they use the experience. In my world, that's not the case, right? A lot of people who are writing commandlets, they don't like them, right? They don't like command. They click next, click next, click next, because that's what they grew up in. And therefore, they didn't understand the ethos, and therefore didn't understand the make a good set of design decisions.
Yeah.
And that's why I think you're right. I should have been harder core and say, I'm not going to give you a set of freedom.
Talking about issues, one thing more, GUIs layered on top of the command line.
Yeah.
That's the one quote I always use. There are so few examples where that works.
Yeah.
In Active Directory, Administrative Center, and Citrix, for example. But the list is so long where this does not work at all. Is the newly released capability of creating a global transcript on the computer, is that the answer from the PowerShell team? Because if you enable the transcription of everything that's going on, this is not well readable for the average guy.
Correct.
So do you confirm that we need more simplicity? We need better tools? We need more GUI tools that really show up? This is what's done behind the scenes. So this design principle is not yet reached.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one of their, I'd say one of the biggest regrets is that we haven't made much progress in a couple different directions. One is the ability to write GUIs in PowerShell. There have been a number of efforts that never really got off the ground. And honestly, part of that is that the whole user interface space is kind of churning itself, right? So there's WPF, and then there was going to be, what was the one, our big thing?
Forms?
Silverlight.
Silverlight.
Right, Forms.
Forms.
Silverlight, WPF, and then Universal Windows.
A bunch of stuff.
It's just kind of spinning. So, so that's part of the problem. And then, that's probably the large That's a large part of the problem. And then the layering GUIs on top of command lines. Where it's done, it's worked out pretty well, but it's not done very often. And then when it's done, they don't always show the command line. Like the new Windows Project Honolulu, Windows Admin Center, that's all web-based stuff layered on top of PowerShell using Gia, just enough admin. So I'm over the moon over this. Like, yes, yeah, this is the right thing to do, but they don't show the command lines.
Yeah.
They said that's coming. But and the nice thing is that they ship with Windows, not in Windows, so they can update pretty frequently.
Yeah, that it hurts, right?
It does.
If you see that. I got one more, and maybe in my career over the last years, it really hurt me more or less physically.
Oh, no.
Nano server.
Oh, yeah.
And birth and death within 11 months. And you might say, no, it's not that. But you always tell us, and I totally apply to this, we have to get rid of the GUIs on the servers.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be honest, server core is not what people expect to use.
Mm-hmm.
So Nano might be the right step towards, because you get a huge benefit in terms of security and simplicity and stuff like that. And now we were told, okay, just right now it's only containers. To summarize this all, how important is it to get rid of the GUIs on the servers? Would you predict something about the future of Nano server as the general approach for delivering workloads beyond containers? Because if you combine this with desired state configuration, and it makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, let's see. So when I was the lead architect of Windows Server, that was something that I was driving quite heavily. And now I'm no longer the lead architect of Windows Server. I'm now focused in on Azure. And so as part of that change, you know, we unified the client and the server teams,
mm-hmm.
and that combined team looked at this area and they said, hey, we think containers are, or sorry, Nano servers simultaneously sort of too large and too small. Too large in the sense of containers, we want it to be as small as possible, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that we don't need. And they've done a very good job there of continuing to reduce the size of Nano server. And then too small in the sense of, for the goal of running physical servers, the ecosystem required a set of diagnostics, a critical mass of diagnostics that had dependencies that were not satisfied by Nano server. And their judgment was that instead of going to fight that fight, go do the heavy lifting to get that ecosystem, that instead that they would focus Nano server on containers. So that was their call. History will see whether that was the right call or not.
Microsoft turns into a more and more also Linux focused company.
By the way, there is a nuance there. So let me go back, because I'm not sure I gave them a fair standing in that. If you recall, in the past, we would say we release an operating system, and then here's a bunch of patches. So mm-hmm. this month there are 14 patches. This month there are 24 patches. This month there's 36 patches. And one of the hypotheses was, well, hey, whenever you patch these things, some of those things require you to do a reboot, right? And so the idea was, hey, if I reduce the surface area, then I can get it small enough, because by the way, some of the things that patch the most of these Windows DLLs, then instead of so many patches, I have fewer patches, and I might be able to reduce the number of times I need to do a reboot. But in reality, we've gone away from that, and there's basically one patch a month.
Yeah.
So
Windows as a service. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, that's one argument for where the hypothesis
fit
sort
together,
of broke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. But I will still point out that, hey, those are patches for a reason, and the reason was they exposed a surface area. And if you're not, if you're using the surface area, you should incur all the costs necessary. Like, that's just the deal. But yeah, if you're not using that surface area, you really shouldn't. And I think from a security standpoint, we really do need the smallest possible surface area.
And I guess the technology needs a reboot to get rid of all the crap. Yeah. Let's be honest. Over the years, hit refresh.
Hit refresh. Hit refresh. That's Satya's term for what he's doing with the company. Yeah. That's the term we use with respect to PowerShell version 6. And the question is, I was trying to do a hit refresh on the OS, and the answer is, yep, we're going to do it in the four applications in containers, but we're not currently on path to hit refresh for physical servers. Yeah, I think that's a good way to phrase it.
Yeah, I think we see. Our target destination now. What I wanted to ask was, if we believe in Microsoft embracing other technologies, foremost Linux, and you get more and more workloads done in terms of Azure, it makes a ton of sense. You said that fabulous quote that you are glad if 100 customers buy 100 Linux machines instead of one customer buy one Windows machine. It makes a ton of sense. Could you retire as a lucky man if you somehow are part of an evolution where Windows became unimportant, but PowerShell survived as the top layer of automation? Do you really care more about the underlying operating system, or do you care more about the API? How do we manage our workloads?
Good question. Well, first I'd say that a couple things. At some point we had dinner with a bunch of IBM executives. Our execs had dinner with the IBM execs, and the IBM execs said, hey, you know, Microsoft, you could be a 100-year-old. IBM is a 100-year-old technology company, and you could do that too. But what you're going to need to learn is that you can't cling. Can't cling to any technology. If we clung to punch cards, we would not be a 100-year-old technology. So what you have to do is you have to pin your corporate ethos around meeting customers' needs and taking that wherever it does. And so if that leads you away from punch cards, you got to go away from punch cards, no matter how much money it made you, how much identity you had wrapped up in that. So basically, you know, I think that's what you're seeing is we're going to lead our technology base where our customers takes it, where it needs to go. And so, you know, by definition, that means a reduced importance of Windows within Microsoft, because now we care about any environment. And then, you know, 20 years from now, you know, where is the role of Windows? I don't know. You know, punch cards did not fare well, but I think operating systems do a little bit better. Now, in terms of me personally, you know, it's always what things did you – I mean, I was lead architect for Windows Server for many years, but I didn't invent Windows Server. You know, PowerShell has sort of got that invention, so, you know, my ego – I try and keep my ego separated from technology, and the answer is I fail when it comes to PowerShell. You know, I do feel a sense of pride in it.
It's super interesting to hear this, the inner details, and it gives you a lot of thoughts about the future, what that's all about. I have two little topics on my sheet of paper where we can finalize that.
Okay.
And the first thing is that one of this of the adorable quotes, and I know a lot of things that you said, and I really like this and quote that over and over again. You said once, it was in 2007, I guess, the PowerShell is the renaissance of the command line.
Yeah.
I really like that because I ask my students, Jeffrey, what does he mean? Does he mean the renaissance of MS-DOS? Is he talking about Unix? What did you mean as you said the renaissance of the command line? What was the first thing that you come back with PowerShell? Was it the idea of Unix?
Well, actually, before I answer that, I'll say that it's one of the reasons why I'm actually pretty friendly to things like Azure CLI, and there's some other kind of like random CLIs that Microsoft's doing. And I look at them at one level, I'm very frustrated that they're not following the standard, they're not plugging in, making it a little bit harder for our customers. But I am very enthusiastic about they are participating in this renaissance of the CLI. Like, hey, these guys have finally figured out that the CLI is important. Now they're implementing it wrong. They're doing it, but they finally figured it out. And basically what had happened was that there had been this like, oh, well, the inevitable progress of computing is to replace this command line interface with the GUI. And the answer is, boy, that was a bad idea. Like, that's a fantastic idea when it's your machine that you're messing with. But when you're trying to manage a data center, my friend, that GUI is not your friend, you know. And when you want to do something like, well, let's be clear. I mean, there's a phrase that I use that I really like because it puts the thing in perspective. Azure, the goal of Azure is to provide planetary scale compute infrastructure, right? We have over 50 regions throughout the world. Going to an individual machine and, you know, with a GUI, click, 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 hello, planet, it just, I mean, it clearly is not going to work. And so basically the renaissance was, no, what we thought was, what a number of people had assumed was a dead technology is not at all a dead technology. It is a vibrant technology. It is the critical technology for something people didn't figure out. I mean, that was I think, my key contribution was, I came in and realized what success looked like, and a bunch of people didn't realize what success looked like. They were so busy feeling great about having won a server sale over the other guy, they didn't realize that, hey, when you're successful, there's going to be thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands, and you need to do something different.
Yeah, that's... This is full circle now, right?
Yeah.
Jeffrey, I really do appreciate that you took your time. Did we forget anything? Is there anything important that we skipped? Did we got all the big bullet points in terms of understanding the past to design the future?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'd say is, you know, a number of people have talked about how it was difficult to move away from the click next, you know, that instant dopamine rush. Like, I click next, I got this, you know, I push this button, I got a peanut, I'm a happy little monkey, to saying, oh, wait, I got to stop, I got to get an IDE, I got to learn the syntax and da-da-da. And so there's this dip in productivity, but then all of a sudden it's like fun, right? Anyway, so my point is that I think that the people have done it and go through the period of discomfort. So that is my big lesson, or big lesson personally that I'm still struggling with, and the thing I try and convey to everyone is that discomfort is the new normal, right? So you got to get out of your comfort zone. You learn these technologies. But guess what? When you learn these technologies, you're going to be very, very powerful, but you're not going to feel more comfortable, because those new technologies are going to lead you to the ability to solve this problem, but you don't know how to solve that problem. So then you're going to feel uncomfortable, but then you'll solve it. But then that's going to lead you to the next one. And the point is that each stage you're going to be uncomfortable, but that's okay. What you're doing is you're being uncomfortable at higher and higher levels of productivity, and then you're going to be rewarded. Yeah. You have larger and larger effects, and you're rewarded more and more and more. There's something odd about when people tell me about their success stories. There's something about triple their salary. Like, the number of people that have told me that they've tripled their salaries is really quite large. Now, I assume that meant that they were starting people, learned PowerShell, and then moved up pretty quickly. But never 4x, 3x, but within years.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think that it really does, you know, there is discomfort, but if you're not uncomfortable, you're probably not doing the right thing. If you look at the amount of transition that's going on and the amount of innovation that's going on, if you're not constantly uncomfortable, you should be uncomfortable about that.
Yeah. I can confess, you made my professional life much and more enjoyable. So, Jeffrey, I do thank you.
Oh.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for what you've done in terms of PowerShell, but I guess it's maybe the most important thing is that you're really on a mission. You really want to embrace people and explain these ideas, and it's absolutely easy to believe. This is a benefit for my personal life, and this is, I guess, this is maybe this is at the end of the story, the biggest achievement.
Oh, excellent! Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Epilogue. I met Jeffrey a couple of times over the course of the last years. I had my 15 minutes of fame when I delivered a talk about all the things I strongly dislike in PowerShell in 2016. The number one celebrity in my audience back then was Jeffrey. You might imagine that this was very special to me. I reached out to him a few weeks before the 2018 European PowerShell conference and asked for this interview, and he responded immediately, "Yeah, let's do it." But when we met in person, it was pretty hard to find a suitable time slot. The simple reason was, he did not want to miss a single session at the conference, literally. So we searched the agenda step by step, until we gladly found a session delivered by one of the PowerShell team members that he was willing to skip, because he already had heard it before. I guess this little story is very telling about Jeffrey's nature, passion, and openness, and I thought it shouldn't be untold.
So he took me over to meet Jeffrey, and Jeffrey was showing me this. Well, first thing that Jeffrey asked me was, do you know anything about Gottfried von Leibniz? I said, yeah, I took a whole bunch of philosophy courses. Of course I do. He's like, great, we'll get together just fine. And then he started showing me the shell and talking about it in the context of the monadology. And I thought, this is freaking brilliant. Like, this is so awesome. I was completely blown away by the thing and absolutely sure it wouldn't work.